write one, in particular, why would a 41-year-old write a memoir? And the answer is that as you read the book, and I hope some of you will have a chance to do it, particularly if your Ambien prescription runs out, that so in case you have trouble sleeping at night. But the book isn't just about me. In fact, the book begins, quite frankly, talking about the story of my grandfather, who was born in 1899 in rural Cuba, and then about my father and about my parents' initial experience when coming to the United States. And I wrote it, A, because I wanted to tell their story and pay tribute to them, but B, but also because I think that through their story I can pay tribute to our country. The realization that while my father was a bartender and my mother was a maid, that's not what I had to grow up to be. And there's nothing wrong with being a maid or a cashier at a hotel. There's nothing wrong with being a bartender. But my parents had dreams that I could be more. In virtually every other society in human history, and in too many countries even today, the son of a bartender and a maid grows up to be a bartender or a maid. Not in America. And I think that's at the core of what we're debating now. How do we protect that? How do we assure that for future generations to be true? I think that's at the heart of our debate in American politics today. I think the left and the right have different views about how to protect that dream and what the sources of that dream may be. And I'm happy to engage in that debate, but I wanted to analyze it through the lens of my parents and my upbringing and where I come from and where I hope to go. In the process of doing that, I hope the book also gave me an opportunity to talk about some other things. For example, the concept of doubt, which, as the book outlines, when I was running for office, everything that I knew about politics told me that I would not win the U.S. Senate race. So much so that I, because of my worries about losing and being humiliated at such a loss, I looked for ways to escape from the race. And it was my family, and in particular my wife, who encouraged me to stay in it, even though she has no political ambitions for herself or even for me. She reminded me that I was in the race to do something, not to be somebody. And I'm glad I went through that, because when all you have in your initial stages of your campaign are your principles, and your belief that someone should advocate those principles, I think that makes you much more accountable to those principles later on in your service. I also get to delve a little bit on the issue of immigration, and I speak about the issue in what I hope is a very honest way from my point of view. I am the son of immigrants, married to the daughter of immigrants, growing up in a community of immigrants. I've had the privilege over the last few days of inviting different journalists to our home for different previews for our book. They had a chance to see exactly where I live. I live in a community where all of my neighbors are from somewhere else, particularly from Latin America. And so I know this issue from both sides. On the one hand, I know the human element of it. The fact that these are people who have come here because they are desperate to provide a better life for their children. And some have come illegally because they're so desperate that they simply can't wait. And I understand that. And I sympathize with that feeling because my parents went through those feelings as well. I also understand, however, that America can't be the only country in the world that doesn't have immigration laws and doesn't enforce them. And to that end, we also need to remind ourselves of how generous America is and has continued to be, where over 1 million people a year immigrate to this country legally. No other country comes close. And there are millions of people around the world, millions of Hispanics, that are waiting to immigrate legally to the United States, who are waiting in line, who have filled out their application, who have paid their fees. I know, because their relatives come to our office looking for help. What are we supposed to tell them? To come illegally because it's cheaper and quicker? So this is not a simple issue, and I think both sides of this issue try to simplify it. It's not just about, it's not as simple as the sides make it out to be. And what I have learned in my year here and talking to my colleagues is that this issue will never be solved in a reasonable and responsible way until it is significantly depoliticized. In essence, as long as immigration is a political issue used by both sides against each other, we will never reach the kind of reasonable and balanced approach to it that it needs and deserves. And it's the reason why I was upset at the way the president did what he did last week, because I think he injected election year politics into an issue that privately I thought we were making progress on. I think it's telling that for more than 3 months I've been discussing openly my idea about how we can accommodate children that are undocumented in a way that takes care of their issue but doesn't contribute to illegal immigration in the future. I think it's telling how little criticism that concept has gotten from the right. Certainly there are voices out there whose purpose for their organization is to oppose any further immigration. But in terms of the right and in terms of voices who in the past have condemned any sort of action, in that regard, I think it's telling how little criticism it got. And again, that's a product of a lot of work, but it's also a product of a realization that we are the pro-legal immigration party. And we're also a party that understands the humanitarian issues these kids face. But we also understand the very legitimate concerns of everyday Americans who are concerned about illegal immigration, including Hispanics, who see firsthand the devastating impact that illegal immigration can have. These things have to be balanced. One last point I would make to prove how hyper-political this issue is. When I first began discussing the issue of the kids and the concept that I had in mind, the New York Times wrote an editorial basically saying my concept should be dismissed offhand, that it was a dream act without a dream. Certain bloggers on the left called it that I was in favor of apartheid, that I was proposing another three-fifths compromise, that I favored second-class citizenship. But now the president has proposed a similar concept, although I don't agree the way he did it, and it's the greatest idea in human history, according to them. The majority leader of the Senate wrote an op-ed in the Miami Herald, my hometown paper, criticizing my idea. Now he hails the same concept that's put in place, not through legislation, but through executive action. So my point being that we need to be honest about this issue as we debate it. We need to recognize, I hope, as a society and as a political process, that it's a complicated issue, that it's not an easy issue to solve, that it has a real human element to it, but it also has a law and order element to it, and I hope I can contribute to that. There are, of course, a lot of other issues facing our country that we discuss as well, particularly my belief in the free enterprise system and my belief that my parents would have never been able to provide a better life for us had they not lived in the American free enterprise system. Someone in America made a lot of money in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, and they used that money to open a hotel on Miami Beach, which employed my father. And enough people around this country made enough money that they could get on an airplane and fly to Miami Beach. And in addition to pay for his salary by visiting there, left him tips, which he used to feed us, and to raise us, and to provide for us. That was true when we lived in Miami, that was true when we lived in Las Vegas, and that was true when we moved back in Miami. We benefited directly through the free enterprise system, because people lived in an environment and in an economy where they were willing to risk their money they could have lost to open up a hotel that employed my mother and father, that opened up the Kmart that employed my mother, and because of that, I had the opportunity to do the things I've been able to do in my life. I close by saying that in the book I say I'm a child of privilege, and I was. Not kind of privilege the way people think of. I don't have a trust fund. My parents didn't even save enough money to pay for my education. That's why I'm still paying my student loans. Although if we sell enough books over the next couple weeks, that may be taken care of as well. But I will say that I was privileged because I was born into a family that was stable, that loved me, that provided us with security, and that encouraged us to dream. My parents never led me to believe, in fact, they told me quite the opposite, that somehow I was limited by what they were. My parents never said, in fact, they were very clear, they made very clear to us that just because he was a bartender and she was a maid, that's not what we had to be. That we could be anything we wanted to be. That in this country, we would have the chance to do things they didn't have a chance to do when they were our age. I think that's true even now. And one of the reasons that compelled me to be in public service is that I think I, people like me, have a special obligation to protect that dream for those who are ahead. There is a bartender and a maid out there right now. There are probably the people working in this very hotel who have a son or daughter like me, 12 or 13, who one day will grow up to hopefully do what you're doing or what I'm doing. And I'll never forget, and I'll never will forget, the special obligation people like me have to continue to provide the kind of country and the economic environment that makes that dream possible. We're not just blessed so we can have, we're blessed so we can give. And for those that have been blessed with American opportunity, we have a special obligation to ensure that that's given to the people that come after us. So thanks for the chance to talk about this.
Thank you.
Did I burn enough time?
You're doing fine. You're well on your way, sir.
It's a skill I picked up.
That's right. No news so far. Let me ask you about immigration. As you know, both Governor Romney and the President are giving speeches this week at the National Association of Latino Elected and Appointed Officials, Romney today and Obama tomorrow. And earlier this week, you told Neil King of the Journal that in dealing with the issue of immigration, quote, we have to approach this issue with a level of strong compassion for that human element as well. As you know, Governor Romney's previous stand on immigration includes what he called self-deportation. Does self-deportation meet the compassionate standard you advocate? And what would you have Governor Romney say today that might begin to close the major advantage the president has with Hispanic voters, which the NBC News Telemundo poll put it 61-27?
Well, let me address three components to that. The first, just on the self-deportation issue that's used against the governor. I think it's important to understand. I've never understood self-deportation and what the governor has presented as a policy. I think it's not a policy. I think it's an observation of what people will do in a country that's enforcing its immigration laws. And I think, quite frankly, some of that is happening now because of economic improvement in Mexico. And one of the great untold stories that people aren't talking about is Mexico. Yes, they have very serious security challenges. It also has a very strong emerging middle class. Growth in Mexico, if I'm not mistaken, is around over 6% this year. And growing, there's an emerging professional and middle class in Mexico. I mean, we have this mode note, and Mexico has a very bright future, especially after this election in a couple weeks here. They make some significant and important decisions in terms of stabilizing their energy market. So I think that the reality of it is that this country is going to face a significant challenge in the next few years, where because of economic improvement in other countries, we may struggle to actually find some of the workforce that we need in agriculture and things of that nature. And I think we need to be aware of that, too.
We had Haley Barber, by the way, say that to us Friday, that we were lucky to have these people working in.
Well, we've got the second point you asked me about. Let me just point for a second on the advantage. There is a historical reality. The Democrats are, in the short term, going to do much better among Hispanics for one very simple reason, and that is that, first of all, there are Hispanics in America. There are a significant number of Hispanics in America that also happen to be liberal Democrats. So it doesn't matter what Mitt Romney's position is on immigration, or mine for that matter. They're not going to support us. And they have a right to be liberal Democrats, but that's what they are. Secondly, I think we have to understand there are geographic realities to how Hispanic Americans perform. And a perfect example that I use are Cuban Americans. Yes, Cuban Americans that move to Miami are disproportionately Republican. But Cuban Americans that move to New Jersey are Democrats. And that's a function of the fact that they live in communities that are dominated by Democratic politicians, and in order to be relevant in the political discourse, you register as the party that's in charge. And that's a reality as well. What I think we should focus on is the growing number of Hispanic voters in key states like Florida, Virginia, Iowa, North Carolina, and others that are much more open-minded, that do not have a long-standing geographic allegiance to one political party or one ideology, who vote for the candidate, not the party. And I think you find that is an increasing demographic. And for that group, I would say that, yes, immigration is an important issue. I call it a gateway issue. Because for Hispanics, immigration is not a statistical debate. It is an issue regarding someone they know and probably someone they love. If you are Hispanic, living in a Hispanic neighborhood, you know someone who's undocumented. You know a kid who's been here since they were 5 years old, but has a deportation order, even though they're the valedictorian of their school. You know someone who is here, yes, undocumented. You know why? Because their kids are hungry and they're sending money back to feed them. And while you understand, it doesn't mean you support illegal immigration. It doesn't mean you condone it. It doesn't mean you think you legalize it. But it does mean that for you, this issue is not just a statistic. It has a human face to it. And I think you have to understand that. By the same token, however, I think it's unfair to say or somehow argue that Hispanics are in favor of illegal immigration. And I think what the Republican Party has to do a better job of, and what I think Governor Romney is doing a much better job of than anybody that I saw running in the primary, is discussing how the Republican Party is not simply the anti-illegal immigration party, it is the pro-legal immigration party. And talking about why legal immigration is important and what we can do to improve our legal immigration system. And there are things that Republicans agree with that would improve our legal immigration system. A functional guest worker program. Improvement in our high-tech visa programs. As part of that effort, an effort to accommodate these kids who find themselves in this specific circumstance. Streamlining and taking some of the bureaucracy out of the process of legal immigration and the visa programs that we have in place. You know, maybe we should look at things like the per-country quota. There's a slew of things that we could look at. And as part of that process, by the way, I think you also look at security, particularly electronic verification, that allows us to increase the value of legal immigration. By ensuring that someone who immigrates legally here to work is somehow not undercut by someone who's here illegally or being exploited by an employer for that purpose. So I think that's what I hope he'll be continuing to lead on. And I think he brings a unique perspective given his business background as to how important immigration is for the future of this country economically.
We're going to go to Jack Farrell, John Gizzi, and Carl Lundsdorf to start. Jack.
Senator, are Republicans getting any blame for the sluggish economy? If so, could that be why you need to see some of your colleagues in the Senate getting together in these ad hoc gangs to talk about what to do about the coming fiscal cliff?
Can you all hear what Jack had to say?
He wants to know how I saved a bunch of money on my car insurance.
That's right. Geico.
Do you want to just rephrase it and I answer?
Sure.
Your question was whether Republicans are getting any blame for the economic downturn, and is that why some of them are now engaged in efforts to actually do something? Okay. Well, let me say two things. Number one is I ran on a platform that very clearly said that many of the problems our nation faces, both Republicans are to blame. Both parties are to blame, including Republicans and members of my own party. And I'll continue to say that. In the book, I clearly talk about one of my biggest frustrations is not that people don't agree with me on policy, is that there's no sense of urgency. There's this sense that somehow the major issues that we confront can wait until after the next election. That's a very dangerous position because there always is a next election. And so if that's your policy, well, you'll never get anything done because, especially today, you're always in cycle, unfortunately, in terms of dealing with these issues. I actually don't think that, although I get that politics is covered as a sport, and so everything is analyzed through the lens of how the next election and whether people are getting blamed and how does it poll. But there actually are people in Washington, I would say the majority of people in Washington, who do would like to get something done, are serving for the right reasons, and are worried about the future. I don't think there's any senator that I have interacted with in the Senate who somehow looks forward to being part of the collapse of our financial markets, the destruction of our credit rating, and the downturn of our economy. I don't know of anyone who wants to see us fall off a fiscal cliff. There are significant ideological differences between the parties. I think the good news is that over the last 10 to 15 days, what this election is about has come into focus. And it's about growth. Both sides now agree that the debate is about how do you grow this economy, because growth solves all of these problems. Growth makes the long-term debt easier to deal with. Growth increases revenue for government. Growth gets people back to work. I think there's a consensus that you can't just only cut your way out of this, and you can't only tax your way out of this. I don't think you can tax your way out of this. I think the only way out of this predicament is how do you grow your way out of this. So now that both sides agree that growth is the issue, we're going to have a debate about how you generate growth. And I think the president's argument is you generate growth by allowing government to generate enough revenue, particularly from high-income earners, so that it can use it to spend through government and its programs. That will create demand. Demand will create growth. Republicans, or at least I believe, and most Republicans believe, that the role of the government is to create the conditions for the private sector to risk their money and create growth. But you can't plan growth. All you can do is create the conditions for growth. And at that point, the entrepreneur will go out and open up a business out of their spare bedroom of their home and employ people. And this is a very valid debate, and I look forward to being engaged in that debate. And if that's what this election is about, I think we're doing a great service for the American people. As far as the efforts that are going on, I just think that there are people sitting down looking at the numbers and saying, I don't think this issue can wait till December. Just because we're having an election doesn't mean that businesses are going to wait till December to decide what their hiring practices are going to be next year. Businesses begin to plan for next year now. Defense contractors and others are planning layoffs because they have to plan for the worst case scenario. And the worst case scenario is an increase in virtually every tax, a massive reduction in government spending, including in defense spending. They have to plan for that. And as those layoffs start coming in, you're going to start to see the impact of that on unemployment and on economic growth. And I think most of us now understand that while we may have an election in November, the impact of this may start to be felt in September. And none of us are going to look good if that happens.
John, is he?
I'm here.
Here you are.
Okay. Thank you, Dave.
Thanks, John.
Questions are twofold.
So much for my one question rule.
He bifurcated it, so he's
right.
Smart.
You see how carefully they follow me. Go ahead, John.
You work closely with Governor Hood. Speaker, and he was governor, and he talks about a 10-to-1 advantage in terms of cuts as opposed to some tax increases, the grand bargaining bill. You now disagree with that premise of Governor Bush. The other thing I was going to ask was, so many Republicans criticized what they call extra constitutional way the president came down with a solution last Friday. Are there any other criticisms you have besides the constitutionality of it?
You thought the immigration decision?
Yes.
Okay. On the first front, I would say that I'm a great admirer of Governor Bush's, and I don't know the context in which he answered that question. I've always rejected that 10-to-1 premise to begin with, because to us, the issue is not taxes. I mean, this is not we get something so you can get some. This is about what works here. This is about what works. And I just don't believe, look, I am in favor of more revenue for government so that government can do two things with that revenue. It can pay down the debt and it can fund the essential things that the federal government should do. The problem is I don't agree with the way they want to generate that revenue. I think the way you generate that revenue is through growth. I think the way you generate that revenue is through more taxpayers, not more taxes. I am not religiously opposed to taxes. I don't think the tax rate should be zero. mean, we do have to generate revenue for government. I just don't believe that raising taxes is going to lead to economic growth. I think it's an anti-growth measure, especially given all the other factors that are in the environment today. What I'm in favor of is tax reform, which requires getting rid of exemptions and flattening the tax code. And in that environment, there are probably some people that are going to lose some of the things they rely on in the tax code. But the purpose of that is not to generate revenue, it's to create fairness and predictability and permanency in the tax code so that then business planners can say, okay, now I know what the rules are, and we're going to invest in the economy because of that. And that's what I'm pushing towards. So this whole idea that somehow we have to give you tax increases in exchange for you giving, just like I'm not in favor of budget cuts just for the sake of cutting. I'm in favor of cutting spending because I think it's important for long-term growth to have a predictable, manageable level of debt moving forward. And that does involve reductions in spending. I've criticized heavily this over-reliance on cutting discretionary spending. You can't get 100% of your cuts on 30% of your budget. It's going to lead to catastrophic, counterproductive cuts. And one of the places I've always railed on is this idea, let's get rid of foreign aid. Foreign aid is a minuscule part of our budget, but you can zero it out, you will do nothing to lower the long-term debt, and you will eviscerate the ability of this country to have influence around the world, not to mention the ability of this country to do good things around the world, like what we do in many parts of the world that not enough people point out. So that's just an example of how this over-reliance on discretionary spending cuts is disastrous for our future. And yet, that's the only thing we can get our hands on because no one wants to talk about the real drivers of the debt, which is a Medicare program that goes bankrupt if we don't save it, for example. So, on your second point about the objections to how the president did it, I don't think this issue is... Well, there are so many unanswered questions. How many people does this apply to? How is this going to work in practice? So are kids really going to come out and sign up and identify themselves as undocumented, and then a year and a half later the policy ends, and now there's a list of undocumented kids in the U.S. with their address and where they live? I mean, there's all sorts of issues that come into play that have been unanswered. It's the reason why we've taken so long to come up with our bill, because we tried to be responsible. We've evolved all the interest groups and all the people that are involved in this issue. That's the way I've always approached legislation. If I wanted a talking point, I would have filed the bill 6 months ago. I'm not looking for a bumper sticker. I'm looking to help real human beings, as many as 800,000 real kids who need a bill that works. I have to have answers to every question you're going to ask. If I put a bill out there and I can't tell you how much it's going to cost, how many people it helps, or how it would work in a certain scenario, I lose credibility. If I introduce a piece of legislation and it immediately triggers a partisan war and name-calling, I set the cause back even further than it's already been set back. So I just think that you look at it and you realize this White House didn't reach out to anybody. I've never had one conversation with anybody in the administration about my idea or what it looks like. And it's not that I need to be called or to feel good about it. I don't care who gets the credit for this. I really don't. That's not the issue. It's not that I want to talk to these guys because I have nothing better to do. It's because if you're really serious about finding a solution to this problem, don't you work with the people who are interested in this? If you're really interested in a bipartisan solution and you read in the newspaper that there's a Republican senator working on an idea, don't you reach out to them and say, hey, how does your idea work? I'm just curious. That never happened. And it's not that my feelings are hurt, but that's not the issue. The issue is it shows that they're not really serious about finding a bipartisan solution. They're interested in a talking point. And I think that's really when I was hoping this issue could be elevated beyond politics. We have so many issues to fight over. Can't we at least just take this one and say, on this one, it's too important, too humanitarian. That's not politics. That was my hope, obviously. It's pretty naive about that.
We're going to go next to Carl Lubsdorf, Ed O'Keefe, Ari Shapiro, and Alex Pappas. Carl.
Hard to take politics out of the things in the election year. But
it's always election year now.
That's true. Let me go back to the discussion of the Republican Party and Hispanics. One of the things that there has always been a segment of the Republican Party that has favored a much more positive policy towards the immigration issue. President Bush comes out of that. But we've seen over the last 20 years the growth of the other side of the Republican Party, starting with the people of California, but spreading now to many Republican politicians in Texas, who've been playing to the right wing of the Republican Party by taking a very hard line. And it's no secret that that's what Governor Romney was doing in the primary, because he couldn't let Santorum and Gingrich and the other candidates get to his right on the immigration issue. The question is, how do you deal with that because of the fact that that view is such a strong part in the Republican Party. There is, I would say, an anti-Hispanic attitude in many areas, but for example, in Texas, I don't think a Hispanic Republican has ever won a major statewide primary in Texas. Hispanic Republicans have had a very difficult time. There's one running this year, you know, Cuban American, who may or may not win. But there is that attitude in many circles of the party which seems to give the impression, at least, of anti-Hispanic.
First of all, I do not concede that being anti-immigration is a conservative principle. Anti-immigration is not a principle of the right or a principle of conservatives. It's a principle of people that are anti-immigration. I do think that law and order is a conservative principle, and I think what's happened in this country, when I got elected to the state legislature in 2000, the immigration issue was not a conflictive issue. I mean, people weren't in favor of illegal immigration, but there wasn't this anxiety about it. The problem got worse, nothing happened about it, and people got frustrated because if you raised objections, what I hear from a lot of people is, listen, my parents were immigrants, my grandparents were immigrants, I like immigration, I have friends who are immigrants, I just want the law to be followed. And if I say that, I'm somehow accused of being anti-immigrant, and people don't like that, and it's not fair. I think there's real frustration with that. And I think the frustration of Americans who have seen the negative impacts of illegal immigration is not an illegitimate position, and we shouldn't delegitimize that position. And I think the left oversimplifies it. I think the left basically says, if you're not for just allowing anybody who's here to stay here no matter what, if you're not for, you know, these kinds of arguments, if you're not for our ideas on immigration, you're anti-immigrant. I think that's an oversimplification of the issue.
It goes beyond the attitude, because, for example, in California, the issue was denying care and access to hospitals among immigrants, and it was used by the Republican Party, by people to a great detriment, I might add, because the Republicans haven't won a statewide.
Well, I've always, and I've addressed that and saying to you that I've said both sides have oversimplified this thing. The right people on the right are guilty of that as well, and there have certainly been voices on the right that have also said outrageous things when it comes to immigration. The vast majority of Republicans, the enormous majority of Republicans, favor legal immigration, have compassion for people that are in this circumstance, and want to see us arrive at a balanced approach that deals with this issue without encouraging or rewarding illegal immigration in the future. I ran what I believe is as a conservative as any campaign in the country, and throughout my campaign, I over and over again talked about the need to figure out an accommodation for these kids. This position about the kids is not new. I consistently said that in the height of my campaign, and I won an election, and a pretty conservative one at that. So I would say to you that that is not a principle that is a majority position in the Republican Party. And I think what is important is that the Republican Party stop being identified as the anti-illegal immigration party and start being the pro-legal immigration party. We need to recognize that immigration has been good for America. We need to recognize that we have a very generous legal immigration system. We need to recognize that we have an illegal immigration problem. We need to recognize that the human element of many of the people that are here in an undocumented status. And we need to recognize the need for a balanced approach to this issue that takes all of that into account. And the people that are concerned about the impacts of illegal immigration have a legitimate point. But the people that ask us to look at the human element of illegal immigration have a legitimate point as well. And it's not an easy answer. It's not an easy issue. And to pretend that it is, I think, does a disservice to the work that we have ahead of us.
Ed.
Senator, beyond immigration, where else might the GOP be dropping the ball when it comes to interacting with, communicating with Hispanics? And forgive me for this, Dave, but in watching interactions with Univision in recent months, I'm curious, what is the English language media, the more established media, missing when it comes to covering Hispanic Americans?
Well, I think there's this idea that somehow Hispanics wake up in the morning and all they think about all day is immigration. That's ridiculous. They certainly care about it. There are people they love, they're impacted by it. But what they worry about in the morning is what you worry about. How am I going to pay my bills on Friday? How am I going to balance my family's budget at the end of the month? Can I stay in business another month without laying people off? I wonder how my kids are doing at school. I'm so worried because my daughter or my son are in college, but they're moving back in with us because they can't find a job. And they have student loans to boot. They worry about what everybody worries about. The one thing I would point out that I think the Wall Street Journal wrote about last week is that the levels of entrepreneurship among Hispanics are higher than in the general population. There is a tremendous number of small businesses in the Hispanic community, and they're directly negatively impacted by big government. People forget that if you are a big major corporation, you can afford the best lawyers in the world to navigate these complex rules and regulations. And if you really don't like them, you can hire the best lobbyists in Washington to change it. But the guy who has a dry cleaner with his wife, the couple that runs a small dry cleaning shop, they can't afford the best lawyer in Miami to navigate local, state, or federal regulations. If they can't comply with that stuff, they go out of business. So I think big government has always hurt the people who are trying to make it. And that demographic of people who are trying to make it is disproportionately reflected in the Hispanic community. We don't talk enough about that. Again, that's something we need to talk about more. And I think that the economic anxieties, and that's what I go back to in my book. My parents' entire life was to leave us better off than them. At some point, my parents realized, look, we're not going to make it work for us. We're not going to be able to do the things that we wanted to do. But the purpose of our life, what will give us, what will give purpose and meaning to our life, is the opportunity to give our kids the chance to do the things we never did. And I think the party and the movement and the candidates that speak to that sentiment and offer credible ideas about what government's role can be in providing that is the party that's going to do best in the long term on that issue. And I hope we'll start working on that.
Ari?
You spent a fair amount of time on the campaign trail with Mitt Romney, and I wonder if you could tell us something we wouldn't expect, something surprising about what he's like to campaign with, what that experience
is. He's funny. I mean, I don't know if you don't expect that, but he's I've never had been on the receiving end of one of it, but apparently he likes to do a lot of pranks. And I've been warned about that in the past. So anytime the phone rings or something, I wonder if it's a prank. But anyway, that he's I think. But the other thing I'll say about Mitt Romney that all of you should know, and I hope not enough attention been paid to, is this is a very successful person. This is not just a successful political figure or a successful businessman. This is a person who has succeeded at every aspect of his life. He's a successful husband, a successful father, a successful leader in his faith community. A successful member of his community wherever he's lived. This is a guy who's made it successful in business, in politics, as a candidate. You don't become successful at so many different parts of your human life without being a good decision maker. And he's just an excellent decision maker. And this is a well-rounded, successful person. And really a role model for the kind of person we hope to have more of in public service.
There's been this public, are you or are you not being vetted debate over the last couple of days. Do you care to weigh in on that at all?
No. I don't talk about process at all.
Alex?
But I have a new book.
Yeah.
Yesterday, Laura Ingraham showed you had some tough words in regards to Fast and Furious. I'd like to ask you, five U.S. senators, as well as Mitt Romney, said that your reporter should resign. Do you agree with them?
Yes. I do. At this point, I do. I think we've now reached the point of no return on this issue. I think they've been given multiple opportunities to answer very legitimate questions that the Congress has. We know for a fact that something they told the Congress was not true. And now I think it's very legitimate for the Congress to inquire as to why we were told something that wasn't true. And they refused to provide materials to prove that. I think the House has provided the Attorney General multiple forums in which he can introduce and answer these questions without endangering the kind of information he thinks would endanger their ability to function in the future, and they've refused to do that. And I think invoking executive privilege at the 11th hour yesterday was probably the last straw in that regard. And I think we're now at the point of no return. I don't know how the Attorney General can continue to exercise that office with any level of credibility after the decision that was made yesterday.
John Wiseman?
Following up on that, the Republican leadership today,
we certainly can't ignore important issues that may be outside of the economic ones. This is an important issue. This was a major mistake. This was made by the Justice Department and the folks who administered this program. And I think there has to, one of the roles of Congress is to have oversight over decisions such as this. And if you refuse to provide information to allow Congress to play that role, really undermines the very principles of our republic and the separation of powers that go in and the role that Congress plays. So, the economy will continue to be the dominant issue, but it doesn't mean we ignore other important issues, whether it's issues on foreign policy or otherwise. And I think political process and our political leaders are capable, better be capable of handling multiple issues at a time, because that's the way the world works. It's not like all these other issues are going to stop because we somehow have a major economic problem that we're confronting.
Todd Gilman.
Thanks. Going back to immigration for a second, why do you think so many people feel that Governor Romney has been so vague? Why has he struggled so much to articulate what his position is? Have you been
Yeah, I don't think he has struggled to articulate his position. He supports legal immigration and anything he can do to improve the legal immigration system. He said very clearly he supports legal immigration. He thinks it's important for our future. He talks about the need to have visas for high performers and folks that can help grow our economy. He's talked about just last week the need to improve the way the legal immigration bureaucracy process works. So, I mean, he doesn't have an immigration bill, per se, but neither does the president, although he's signed on to other pieces of legislation. He hasn't really lined up behind them. When his party controlled the House and the Senate, with 60 votes in the Senate and Nancy Pelosi in the House, they didn't put this at the top of their list. They proceeded with other things they wanted to do. I think the other recognition of it is that this is not an issue that's easily solved on the campaign trail. As I've outlined to you, this is not a simple issue. This is not yes or no issue. This is an issue of complexity and nuance that has to be approached in a responsible way. Both sides of the argument have legitimate points. And I think what you're seeing is an indication of a very mature and serious political leader who understands that as president, he's going to have to balance those things and coming up with a solution. This is not an issue that's easily, you know, solved in campaign talking points and bumper sticker language.
He certainly seems to be having trouble. Senator McConnell just said the other day, where Governor Romney is on this, 6 days after the president's announcement about the 800,000 kids, and we don't really understand where Romney is on this. I mean, shouldn't we be working in more real time? I mean, it may not be solvable during the campaign, but it is a live issue.
Well, I think Governor Romney's principles on immigration are pretty straightforward and pretty much in line with the majority of Americans, which is he understands that immigration is important for our country, and he understands that our legal immigration process is broken and needs to be fixed. The specific solutions about how to fix that has to be a part of a serious, responsible process, not part of a political back and forth where I think that the way he's approaching it is the responsible way to approach it. I think the irresponsible way to approach it is to politicize the issue and to make it harder to come up with a kind of reasonable response.
Laura Meckler.
My question actually just follows right on that. So do you think that he's okay where he is right now in terms of his immigration policy? He doesn't need to offer any further clarification or further refinement?
Well, I think as part of the process of the campaign, as he interacts with people and specific issues come up, he'll have the opportunity to do that. He has a speech today, and we're all interested to see where the speech is at and some of these issues. But look, I think in by and large, the governor's already laid out if you look at all the things he said, he's laid out the broad parameters of a concise process on immigration, which is, principle number one is that legal immigration is important for America and good for America. Number two is we have an illegal immigration problem that has to be addressed so that we can win the confidence of the American people, so that number three, we can have once again a modern 21st century legal immigration system that's fair to the immigrant and good for America. And now, there's a lot of complexity in how you design a system like that. For example, everybody says they're in favor of a guest worker program, but even among Democrats, there's the dispute as to what it looks like. There's regional fights about what the wage scale should be in a guest worker program for agriculture between the Southwest and the South. I mean, these issues are much more detailed than just simply saying, I'm in favor of this, I'm in favor of that. And I think as a responsible policymaker, he understands that as president, he'll have to lead a discussion that balances all of these equities. Well, I think it'll continue to develop as the campaign goes on. You'll have opportunities to opine on these issues. But I think, in general, his principles on immigration are solid and in line with the majority of Americans in his support of legal immigration.
Alexandra?
Hi. Energy is going to be a fairly large issue in the upcoming election, and Romney has said that that's a big issue for him as well. Recently, the U.S., over the last few years, has seen a surge in their domestic natural gas supply with the shale gas boom. Florida in particular has the pipelines they're building through. They also have an import project that's currently, I believe, stalled right now. But there's an issue in Congress right now over whether to keep the gas here or export it. There's about 14 projects sitting at the DOE right now. Chenier in Louisiana was approved. What is your view on the idea of keeping the gas, exporting the gas, and overall in terms of keeping domestic energy in the U.S. versus exporting?
Well, first of all, I hope that our domestic energy markets will expand to the point where that issue will be moved. In essence, we'll have plenty of supply, not just to provide our domestic needs, but also to be a net exporter of energy. And I think we can certainly get to that point, especially on natural gas, if this country has a concise energy policy. If one of the things that doesn't receive enough attention is that America does not have a comprehensive, well-stated energy policy. It has energy politics. And I've heard from multiple businesses and others, both globally and here in the United States, that they just want to know what America's for so they can adjust to that in terms of energy. I think from a domestic energy perspective, it's important that we have a stable and affordable supply of domestic energy because it, for example, makes manufacturing more cost-effective. It'll actually allow us to attract manufacturing in some sectors back to the United States. But I also think that we shouldn't diminish, and that's why I hope the supplies reach that level where it's not a choice between domestic consumption and export. Because I think that this new supply of American energy, particularly in the natural gas realm, is a real, for lack of a better, or I guess to use an overused term, is a real game changer in terms of energy. And I think it goes beyond just the United States. I think we need to look at the Western Hemisphere and the potential the Western Hemisphere has to become an energy zone that really, in some places, begins to displace the instability of the Middle East in regards to some of these policies. You look at Canada's ability to now access more energy because of American innovation, and that's what the Keystone Pipeline debate is about to some extent. Obviously, our policies, but also Mexico. Colombia has begun to get into and then you see a lot of a brain drain out of Venezuela and into Colombia, helping Colombia to expand its energy sector. Obviously, Brazil, and a post-Chavez Venezuela could also become part of this kind of Western Hemispheric energy bloc. I discussed this in my speech in Brookings, that could really begin to improve the global energy markets and begin to replace not just the stranglehold that Russia has on Europe with regards to natural gas, but also the destabilizing impact that the instability in the Middle East has on energy supplies around the world.
Mike Mamoli.
Senator, you said earlier that you ran the most conservative campaign in the country in 2010.
I said one of the most conservative, yeah.
Governor Barber was here last week at this breakfast, said that Mitt Romney was the least conservative candidate in the primaries. I'm wondering if you would agree with that, and would you say that Governor Romney is running a strong conservative?
I would not agree with that assessment, and I wouldn't, again, on this issue of who's the most conservative in the primary, I think they were all conservative candidates. I think all of them were. I think the Republican Party is a center-right party. I think that's where America is for the most part, on issue after issue. And I think Governor Romney reflected that, and that's why he won the primary, and that's why I think he's going to be the next president of the United States. I do think he's running, not only do I think he's running a conservative campaign, but I believe that Governor Romney will, I know that he'll govern as a conservative as well in his principles. I also think he has a track record of accomplishment and a track record of being able to turn principles into reality, into ideas, and I think he'll do that again, and particularly as you balance some of these complex issues that we've talked about.
We've got two last. We're going to David Harrison, then we're going to finish with Andy Glass. David.
Thanks. Senator, the Republican leadership, both of the House and the Senate, has made it pretty clear to telegraph there's no hurry to have a debate on immigration this year. Speaker Boehner, whenever he asks me, I always say that I'm talking about jobs and the economy. Is this a mistake? Do you think the leadership in your party should be engaging on this a little more?
Well, I think there's a lot of different opinions on that issue. I haven't spoken to Speaker Boehner about the agenda they've outlined between now and the election. One of the things I have said is that when I started to pursue this idea about helping the kids, one of the things that some people would tell me, some Democrats, Republicans, was, I get it, but why should this issue take priority over the economy, taxes, the debt, et cetera? And the argument I would make is, well, we need to have some urgency because these kids want to go to school in September. They want to go to college. I have kids in Florida that have been here since they were 5 years old, are valedictorians, have been accepted to Dartmouth, and have a deportation order. They want to go to college in September. And one of the things that's happened as of Friday is that argument's now gone, at least in the short term. Obviously, I have bigger complaints than that, but that's one of the things I've heard. That being said, I do think this is an issue that if we can reach a consensus on, we need to move forward and try to do something. I get paid to be a senator all 6 years, not 2 years on, 6 months off because we have an election. That's my view. My view is that just because you have an election coming up doesn't mean there are, and my own view also is that we should not be incapable of advancing several important issues at the same time. So I would last tell you that I think immigration is related to the economy. I think if you talk to agriculture, They'll tell you that the inability to have a functional worker program hurts American agriculture. I think if you talk to the service sector, they will tell you the inability to have a functional guest worker program hurts agriculture. I think if you talk to the high-tech community, they will tell you that the inability to keep PhDs in the United States and hurts the economy. I think if you realize that we are not allowing people to stay in this country that have $1 million they want to invest in creating jobs in the United States, people would say that hurts our economy. That's why I filed the bipartisan bill called Jobs 2.0 with Jerry Moran, Mark Warner, and Chris Coons, that deals with an immigration component, because immigration is having a functional legal immigration system that's modern and reflects the 21st century is an economic issue.
Last question, Andy Glass.
Interesting morning, Senator. Thank you.
Thank you.
But it doesn't change the fact, or I would suggest to you, that the 112th Congress is being held in minimum high regard by many Americans. So let's fast forward to next January. The Republicans take control of the Senate. They retain control of the House. And your favorite candidate, President Romney, is coming to Congress with ideas. Why doesn't it just flip? Why do the Democrats, who at least have a blocking power, keep doing much of what Republicans are doing today?
They might.
My question then, sir, is how do you change this?
Well, two things. The House has passed a bunch of legislation. I think all this talk about the Senate needs to rewind to that. Until this week, the Senate hasn't functioned the way it has. I mean, literally, amendments have not been offered, have not been allowed. And that's what's led to this gridlock in the Senate as much as anything else, is that Senator Reid has refused to allow votes on amendments on the floor because he's trying to protect his members from taking votes that could hurt them in their election. And this process can't function if senators aren't allowed to offer amendments that are germane on a bill. So, I mean, that's a fact. And I hope that if Republicans take the majority, we won't behave that way. That being said, a day of reckoning is coming. We can ignore all these issues, but these issues will not ignore us. The U.S. has a broken tax code, and if it doesn't fix it, our economy won't grow. The U.S. has a problem with regulations, that even though we need to have regulations, we want our water to be drinkable, we want our air to be breathable, and we don't want businesses to be taking advantage of people or vice versa. But at the same time, if regulations become too difficult to comply with, people won't do business here, and that's going to hurt us. We have a long-term debt problem that isn't going to pay itself off. We're going to have a plan to deal with this long-term debt. So we are going to have to deal with these issues, or these issues are going to deal with us. And at some point, I hope that the urgency of this reality will begin to spur people to at least begin to talk about these issues. I mean, I have been here a year and a half. We have had no budget in the Senate. We have had no debate about tax reform. We have had no debate about how to save Medicare. We have had no debate about regulatory reform. We have had no debate about any on energy policy. What are we doing? What do we spend all our time on except the talking point of the week? And I hope Republicans aren't a part of that, because I'll criticize it too. We have to begin to deal with these issues. And if there's any takeaway on the political part of my book, it's my frustration at this utter lack of urgency with these major issues that are going to really hurt us, and in so doing, hurt the world.
Did you feel, just to close, that you were revealing too much? I was struck reading parts of the book last night, I haven't read every word, about how revealing you were about your dealings with your wife, feeling guilty about not being at home. Do you regret what you've done in terms of pursuing this political career? There were times in the book when it sounded very poignant anyway.
Do I regret going into politics?
Or do you regret the balance in your life?
I worry about it. I think one of the things I wanted to put in the book was that concern. I'll give you a perfect example. This morning, someone asked me, and I guess on a radio show, so I guess it was reported, that I'm not going to some event in Utah. It's unfair to the, by the way, I'm not talking about the vice presidential process.
It's the Park City fundraising.
But it's unfair to the Romney campaign to say I was excluded, because it's not accurate. I was invited to go. Here's the reality, though, and I think it ties right into my book. I end my book with a story. The story is that I was in the Senate one day, and Pat Leahy comes up to me and says, "How are you doing?" You know, just small talk. And I said, "Well, you know, I don't know why I answered him. Seriously, I said, you know, I'm worried about my kids have this thing this weekend. I'm not going to make it." And his whole expression changed from a guy who was doing small talk to a guy that had something to share. And he said, "You know, when I was around a little younger, I don't know, I think he was just a little bit older than I was when he got in the Senate." He said, "President Ford had called him and invited him to an event. And it conflicted with something that one of his kids had. And he turned the president down. He says 30, 40 years later, he doesn't even remember what the event was, but his kids will never forget the day that he chose them over the president. And I use that example that I had an opportunity earlier this year to go to Africa. It was going to be a pretty good trip. I care a lot about the PEPFAR program, and I had a chance to go to Africa on a bipartisan trip to learn about how the U.S. is literally saving the lives of 4 million people who depend on us for antiviral medication. But my kids had all kinds of stuff going on. My daughters, my sons had just started flag football. They needed their parents at home, and I had to make a decision. We were packed. We were driving to the airport when I said, you know what, we're not going. And I'll never forget the look on my kid's face when their dad showed up to pick them up from school. They thought I was in Africa. I mean, in a kid's mind, you know, you get there in 10 minutes. I don't know if I would have remembered that trip had I not put it in the book, but my kids will never forget the day I picked them over Africa and picked them up to take them home. And it's the same thing with this, you know, I've been on the road since Sunday on the book thing. I have to go to Orlando tomorrow for a speech. I have to be back in D.C. on Monday for Sunday for Meet the Press. Then I have a whole other week here. If I had gone to Utah, I wouldn't see my kids for 15 days. So I had a choice there, and I chose my kids. And, you know, that's what the book talks about. And I guess when you make those choices, you know, whatever the consequences are. But I know that 30 years from now, none of us will remember that report. But my kids will never forget that I was home on Saturday. So.
Thanks for sharing that. Thanks for coming, sir. Appreciate it.
Did your kids go for DP?
Huh? No, I said Utah. Don't put them.